Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and thank you once again for joining us as we continue to pour through the big monster box full of memories and, oh yeah, more than its fair share of common cards from the 1980s and early 1990s. We're still plowing through 1991, although we're at the last couple of sets from that year. Next podcast on Friday, we will do 91 Tops, one of my favorite sets, and also, in my opinion, the last basic fun baseball card set, as the hobby would just ramp things up in 1992, mostly in response to Upper Deck. And a response to Upper Deck came in 1991 as well, in the form of Top Stadium Club, and that is the set that we're going to be looking at today. Our random poll card number 304, Roberto Alomar. One of my favorite players, not only because, as you know well by now, I was a Toronto Blue Jays fan as a kid. He was one of the two players the Blue Jays received in arguably the biggest trade in franchise history back in December of 1990. Roberto Alomar and Joe Carter going to Toronto for Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez. They went out to San Diego. And of course, McGriff and Fernandez served the Padres well for a few years. But without Alomar and without Carter, the Blue Jays not only don't win two World Series in 1992 and 93, it's doubtful that they even get that first one in 92. So always remember Roberto Alomar well, even though there was quite a bit of controversy surrounding his career and personal life. But when you look at what he did on the field, it was spectacular. He had the bat, but he was more well-known for his glove and his competitiveness, so much so that he was inducted into the Hall of Fame several years ago on his second ballot. Just narrowly missed it on his first. I think he had like 70.3% of the vote, and you need 75 to get in. So he was able to make it on round number two in 2011. Still the only Toronto Blue Jay, or at least former player enshrined as a Blue Jay in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, before we talk about Roberto Alomar and the spectacular 1991 Top Stadium Club set, and before we talk about what you're talking about, I know what you're already talking about. You're thinking, boy, Matt is talking through his nose today. Yes, I am. Forgive me. I've got a little bit of the munge that is going around town basically these days. You know, it's cold and flu season. It's just that time of the year. And, you know, I don't know where you live, where you're listening to this, but in Florida, we don't get colds and flus because of, you know, 8 inches of snow or an Arctic blast of air coming down through the Canadian prairies, you know, much like our friends to the north of us do. We get it because it is so stinking hot in December. You know, we really don't start getting sustained cold snaps until January. And when I say cold snaps, I mean a high of 60. But we don't really get sustained cold snaps until January. So in December, it gets into pretty much the low to mid 80s, which sometimes is pleasant. Other times it's flat out miserable. But every now and then it cools down just enough. You know, the highs get into like the low 70s. And then it gets right back up into the mid 80s again. And this little dance that we do with mid 80s, low 70s, that really messes around with pollen in the air. People are coughing and sneezing. I've got two young kids at home, so of course they're picking up illnesses from school and daycare, and we just pass it around the house. So if you have young kids, you know what I'm talking about. If you've ever lived in Florida, you know what we're talking about. So bear with me. This will be a very nasally edition of the Wax Ecstatic podcast, but I can tell you it will be fun, again, based on our random poll, Roberto Alomar and the Top Stadium Club set. All right, first, something that we put out there in our last podcast, and I'm going to put it out there again because in all the hubbub of the Christmas holiday weekend, I forgot to put out a tweet that asked this question, and that's always good to get a little more of a response. In our last podcast, we were talking about 91 Donruss. And 91 Donruss was not a bad set. However, after the 91 Fleer set, it certainly looked a lot better. And of course, after the 90 Donruss set, it looked better. So I asked, what are your top 10 worst sets? In your opinion, the top 10 worst sets of all time. And of course, we're looking more for the major brands here, you know, not the, you know, the Topps Kmart collection. We all know that one sucked. But, you know, just any thoughts you have from your collecting days of the worst sets that you saw. And we came across a few of them in recent podcasts. Of course, 91 Fleer. Nobody likes that one. 90 Donruss. That is not a fan favorite. 88 Donruss, even though I like the design of it, that's kind of the poster child for overproduced baseball cards with, you know, lacking rookie classes or star cards, even though there were a lot more sets created in 1990 or 91 that had that issue than 88 Donruss. But, you know, again, it's got the stigma wrapped around it. Of course, 82 Fleer is one of my least favorites. It may be the worst one. I haven't exactly assembled my top 10 list, so give me a few days. I'll come up with my top 10 list. We encourage you to send us your top 10 list. Just to respond at Wax and Gum Stains. And we do have Wax Pack 916 writing in with us. Top 10 worst sets, 86 Topps. Now, that's a bit of a surprise, because even though I was never a big fan of 86 Topps, I know some people love that set. Like I said, I wasn't big on it. I wouldn't call it one of the worst sets, but, you know, to each their own. But yeah, that's definitely not one of my favorites. A 91 Fleer, 90 Donruss, 89 Score. Well, we're in agreement on that. 82 Fleer, yep, you bet. 82 Donruss, yeah, you know, 82 Donruss was pretty boring. I likened it to using clip art or cut and paste art. If you listen to our 82 Donruss podcast from way back when, Larry Heisel of the Milwaukee Brewers was our random poll. You can hear me kind of pick apart that set, even though when you compare it to Fleer and Topps that year, Donruss might have been the best one that year. We continue, 88 Donruss, yep, 89 Bowman, 90 Bowman, and 83 Fleer. Well, I'm going to disagree with you on the last three. You can listen to the podcast on those three. 89 Bowman, I'm giving a second chance. 90 Bowman, I'm giving a second chance to, because I really feel that 90 Bowman was what Bowman was really supposed to be in 89 had they not made the card bigger. And 83 Fleer, I've always liked 83 Fleer, not only on the surface and because of the rookie class and some of the star cards, but for me, that was the first of many great sets. I really thought Fleer produced some winning sets, some of the best sets in the industry from 83 to 87. But even though I wasn't a big fan of the 88 and 89 set, I love the 90 set. So you could say 83 through 90, you know, coming out with a pretty good product eight consecutive years, that's not very easy to do. Now, Wax Pack 916 would continue. Honest, other than the first four sets, I give the rest a pass. So basically, of your top 10, you're holding 86 Topps, 91 Fleer, 90 Donruss, and 89 Score to the test. I do agree with those last three, and if I were to assemble my top 10 list now, they would definitely be up there. So again, my bad for, and thanks for responding, Waxpack916. At least I know somebody's listening. hey, you were busy on the holiday weekend too. So again, I'll schedule a couple tweets during this week leading up to our next podcast. Top 10 worst sets. If you could put them in order 1 through 10, that would be great. And we'll look at them in this upcoming podcast. And I'm sure that of the 10 sets that you give me, 7 of them, everybody else will hate. And you can pretty much guess which 7 of those sets would be in there. Oh, we had a very interesting retweet. Ryan Cracknell, who is one of our listeners, he is the Beckett Media hobby editor. So thank you so much for following us, Ryan, and listening to the podcast. He posted a picture of a Sears Christmas catalog. And it's actually an article that's on Beckett.com. This was right before Christmas Day. And he has this nice little blog post about, you know, fond memories of 1991 in particular. And it goes on to say baseball cards in the 1991 Sears Christmas catalog. Now, for those of you who are too young to remember when your Christmas list came out of these catalogs, I talked about it in a previous podcast, but let me just do a quick reminder here. And most people who are listening to this, again, you're probably around 40, maybe a little older, maybe a few years younger, but you do remember this because before the internet came in and everybody did their shopping there, at least through, I would say, the late 1990s, you assembled your Christmas wish list with the department store catalogs. And as baseball cards became more and more popular, in particular the late 80s and early 90s, all of a sudden, the baseball card section of a department store catalog was not just one or two little blurbs of items for sale. It was literally four or five pages, as was the case of this 91 Sears catalog. But some of the amazing things here, the prices of some of these cards. So Ryan goes to point out that Upper Deck was going for $47. That's right, $47 for the complete set. You could probably buy two for that price. And a lot of the other main sets, of course, the lovely Fleer set, Donruss tops as well, were selling for around $30. Now, for a set like Topps, if you pay $30 for it, you're paying too much. You can get those for about $20. But if you're looking at Donruss, Fleer, the monstrosity that is the 91 score set, the 900 card set is in here as well, $30. Yeah, you might be able to get three factory sets for that price now. And you may even get postage paid on that. You wouldn't even have to pay the extra, you know, $20 or whatever to get it shipped to you. And of course, that's just the story of the hobby, the story of the times there, but it is rather humorous to look back on that. But then there are, you know, some other things that they have here in, you know, collectibles. That's what they classify them as. And I just absolutely love some of the collectible stuff that was featured in here. First of all, you had the Deluxe Baseball Card Collector Kit, which had the binder. It also had a whole bunch of the nine pocket collector pages, and then the quote unquote assorted out of print cards, no duplicates. Well, that's the key thing there. You had no duplicates, but the out of print cards in 1991, you know what those were, right? Those were the 90 Donruss, the 89 score, those types of cards. So you could get that kit for an incredible price of just $14.99. That also included 100 top card loaders, which actually wasn't that bad. Now, the Deluxe Baseball Card Value Pack. These were the ones that I used to get all the time. I would ask for these, and it wasn't from the Sears catalog. I used to get them, believe it or not, from the Amway catalog. My family didn't sell Amway. Somebody else we knew did, so we contributed to somebody else's Ponzi scheme. But I used to love, there was a 250 card set, which came in a 400 card box. And you had a pretty neat assortment there. You know, 1990, 91, I would get those. And they included, you know, 10 or 12 cards from like the late 70s, which was actually very uncommon in these assorted card collections. And then one year I got, I think it was labeled as a 500 card assortment. And the box, it was kind of a big box. You could probably hold about 700 cards. But I remember they just randomly threw in a 1958 Topps card. Now, it was a common card, but finding a 1958 card in a 1991 assortment of cards was pretty neat. So I actually liked those sets. But here in the Sears catalog, the Deluxe Baseball Card Value Pack with a quote-unquote whopping 1,600 original out-of-print cards from Topps, Fleer, Donruss, Score, and Upper Deck comes in two attractive, sturdy cardboard storage boxes, price guide included. I'm sure that was accurate, for $31.77. So, and I'm looking at this picture that's coming with it. There's a whole lot of 88 Topps. A whole lot of 88 Topps in that. Wow. Ryan Cracknell of Beckett.com, thanks again for posting that a few days ago. And again, check our Twitter timeline. Check out Ryan's Twitter timeline. I'm sure Beckett's got it too, looking back at the 1991 baseball card catalog. Oh, that gives you some memories. Real quick, talking about 91 Donruss, which we just discussed, our friend Ben Adams chimes in with improvement from 90 set. Again, you know, the 90 Donruss set, you know, set the bar pretty low. He continues, I liked all the MVP, All-Star, and World Series cards and the Diamond Kings as usual. I will say this about Donruss, whether the set was good or not, trying to collect the 27 Donruss Diamond King cards, and card number 27, of course, was the checklist, but cards 1 through 26, you know, each team was represented as a Donruss Diamond King. You know, it was almost like an all-star team. And you had some pretty interesting players that were selected throughout the years. So, you know, each team got represented, but sometimes you're looking and it's like, wow, Dave Parker's representing the Brewers. Okay, that's an odd choice. So, yeah, you know, some pretty good cards in there. And in regards to Ken Griffey Jr., our random poll, the kid had the sweetest swing I've ever seen. Real shame he got hurt. And we couldn't have had a, and he puts in capital letters, real home run champ. Well, I do agree with you. And one other thought on 91 Donruss from Tim Murray. Donruss is the gaudy Christmas sweater of baseball cards. That comment was so good, I had to retweet it. I never looked at it that way. Remember, I talked about 91 Donruss as having, you know, these parallel lines and tire track impressions. I never thought of tacky Christmas sweater, but more blue Series 1 than green Series 2. But yes, I absolutely see where you're coming from. Oh, one more comment here. My bad. Josh Olson just recently heard of Wax and Gum Stains, and now I'm voraciously devouring past episodes of their podcast. Give them a follow and a listen. Well, thank you so much, Josh. We appreciate that. And he continues, especially excited to begin the 1989 Bowman episode, which features my man, Mr. 4040, Jose Canseco. All right, so plenty of conversation on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. Spread the word, let other people know about it, and let everybody know about the Wax Ecstatic podcast. So the podcast will be coming to you twice a week via Audio Boom and iTunes. And again, we're looking for a sponsor as well. I'm not looking to overload anybody with commercials. I'm not looking to make a mint here. I'm looking to connect a product or service with our growing, very dedicated fan base here listening to Wax Ecstatic. And if you feel that you have that product or service or know somebody who does, please direct message the Wax Ecstatic Twitter handle. That is, of course, Wax and Gum Stains. And we'll try to make a deal for everybody. There are some production costs here. We want to try to cover those. But again, we just want to link up good people with good products or services to good listeners. And again, a growing fan base. All right, 91 Top Stadium Club. This is one of my favorites for a number of reasons. One, it's just a damn good card. Two, it too helped change the hobby tremendously. Much like 89 Upper Deck did, Top Stadium Club really showed the way of what the quote-unquote average baseball card company could do in terms of making premium products. And also, Stadium Club is still alive and well today. Of course, Topps is the only producer of officially licensed Major League Baseball and Major League Baseball Players Association cards. So naturally, anything that falls under the Topps umbrella, and that includes Bowman, is still alive and well. But, you know, Stadium Club was one, even when there was the glut of cards in the early 90s, and then it just got really ridiculous in the mid to late 90s, Stadium Club still put out a pretty decent product throughout the years. And it set itself apart, and what makes it really unique today is there is still something unique about it, even though the standard, you know, base top set is essentially very similar to the Upper Deck and Stadium Club sets of the early 90s. You know, the bar was raised so high that you had to keep it up there. And that's in terms of design and, you know, the glossiness of cards and inserts and photography and stuff like that. But in 1991, Stadium Club was a very interesting answer to the premium card product. Now, again, the 89 Upper Deck podcast, if you haven't heard it yet, please go back and listen to it. Devote a little bit of your day. It is a little over an hour. It's the longest one I've done. I swear I try not to make these podcasts too long, but with good reason, because 89 Upper Deck changed the hobby so much. Now, I think some people give it a little too much credit. I really do think it was the catalyst towards changing everything and raising everything up a few notches. But it's not like 89 Upper Deck came in and just totally took over the entire baseball card hobby. It didn't quite happen that way. A lot of people remember it that way. And while they did do some revolutionary things, some things that Upper Deck did starting in 1989, other companies were doing before them, and other companies would very quickly initiate them. And Top Stadium Club did something that Upper Deck wasn't doing. They would eventually get around to it in 1993. And that is the first thing that you're going to notice about the Top Stadium Club card. So let's take a look at Roberto Alomar, a random pull here, card number 304. When you look at the front, what is the first thing that you notice? It is all picture. And I've said this before about the Upper Deck sets in 89, 90, and 91. You would see this in 92. Even though people said, oh, they're so revolutionary, they're changing the hobby. Well, yes, in many ways they did, but they also had a lot of room for borders. There's always a white border. In fact, you look back at 89 Upper Deck, there's a lot of room taken up by border space and graphic art space, and not necessarily photography. Well, Topps Stadium Club totally blew that out of the water, to the point where Topps Stadium Club changed the hobby. Upper Deck would do it in 93, having pretty much an entire photograph on the front of the card. And certainly by then, a lot of the other card companies were going with that. Fleer Ultra would figure that out. That's what they did in 93. I believe Score did that as well in like 93 or 94. So did Donruss. By, you know, the mid-90s, everybody was doing pretty much a border-free baseball card front. And it all starts with Topps Stadium Club. And not only did they use the entire front of the card, devoting it to photography, but it was, dare I say, award-winning photography. And if you look at the picture we tweeted out yesterday promoting this upcoming podcast, you'll see the Kodak stamp that's on there. Now, the Kodak company, even though the business is just barely there, they still produce some great quality photography. And it was so good that they basically co-opted Topps Stadium Club in 1991 and future years as well. So you have these almost Kodachrome-like crispness to the photos. You know, here's a picture of Roberto Alomar mid-swing in spring training in Dunedin. And you've got a great shot of him, you know, looking to connect with the ball here. Now, while the ball is blurry, after all, it is coming in at Roberto at about 93 miles an hour, the motion of Alomar going through his swing is very crisp, like I said, and I think that's the best word for the photography here. And really, the colors pop out here, the old Blue Jay uniforms, you know, which they brought back to an extent over the last couple seasons. And the only artwork that intrudes on this is what we call in the TV industry a lower third. So a little bit of a blue bar down at the bottom, outlined in gold foil. You have the player's name in that blue line. To the right, you have a slightly intrusive Topps Stadium Club logo. And that was it. There you go. No position, no team name, nothing. It was just the player. Now, something else that was unique about the set, and if you go looking, you know, go through Google Images and just type in 91 Topps Stadium Club, you had some very unique photographs here as well. The infamous one, and I mean this in a good way, is Nolan Ryan in the windup while wearing a tuxedo. I mean, how, you know, bizarre is that? But it worked. There were a lot of pictures in this set. While you had some action shots and some stage shots, you also had some studio shots like Nolan Ryan wearing a tuxedo while pitching and wearing a Texas Rangers hat. So, you know, you had some off-the-wall pictures, but some very, very neat pictures as well. So the front grabbed the attention very quickly. The back, if you flip it over here, this was a total departure not only from Topps, but certainly from the rest of the industry as well. You've got a full color back here, and we're not just talking about the, you know, two color back, you know, like 91 Fleer. No, you've got the baseball diamond kind of a sketching in the background. You also have the card number, you know, in an upper third, I guess you can call it, card number, stadium club logo, player's name up at the top, followed by the team name, the position, personal information. Then right beneath that, you have the scouting report here. And it's all about where Roberto liked to hit the ball. You know, basically, you know, where to pitch him, where not to pitch him. Where have we seen this before? Aha! We saw this back in 87 Fleer, so this isn't necessarily a new idea, but how Topps Stadium Club framed it made it look new. This was a departure from what Topps had been doing for years, which of course was show some stats, show some personal trivia, maybe some baseball trivia, and that's that. Here, they actually get into the sabermetrics, if you will, on where to pitch Roberto Alomar and where not to. And just beneath it, there is a little text box there with a scouting report. And it basically says exactly what that chart says. You're not really revealing anything new here. So it's not quite like the score baseball set scouting reports. No, like I said, it's basically repeating what you see in the box above. But it was a neat little thing to add in there. You also had, when it came to stats, you just had the previous season stats and the career stats. Again, a departure from what Topps had been doing for a long time. The last time Topps just did previous year, career year, was 1971. And that was something that they did through much of the 1950s. But for the most part, you had the complete professional career stats of a player up there. So if you wanted to see what he did in, you know, double A bum squatch Iowa, it was on the back of the player's card. Not so in this case. Now, what was also interesting, and I've always loved this about Stadium Club, and it would continue beyond 1991, but the player's rookie card was featured on there. Now, of course, it was always a Topps branded rookie card. So in the case of Roberto Alomar, his rookie card is the Topps traded rookie card. But again, let's go back to pre-internet days here. So back when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, you know, that's how I feel like when I talk about pre-internet, you know, pre-1995. You know, the only way to see old baseball cards was to either collect them yourself, go to a card shop that collected them and sold them and showcased them, or C, hope that the Beckett baseball card monthly price guide showed your favorite player's rookie card, which was not that common because they would only show one card per set per year. So this was the first time, at least in my life, that as I collected these cards, I could not only see like a Roberto Alomar rookie card, I could see Nolan Ryan's rookie card. I could see Carlton Fisk rookie card, George Brett, Robin Yount. You name it. Whoever was, you know, a big star in the day, Paul Molitor, Dale Murphy was still playing then. You know, you could see his rookie card. So the chance to see a player's rookie card from like 1983 and before was pretty unique. You know, Mark McGwire's rookie Topps card was the 85 Topps card with him playing for the United States Olympic team in 1984. So you had a really unique window into the past on the back of every card. And I remember as I collected these, sometimes not even looking at the front of the card, just looking at the back, I would take a stack of them and thumb through them and look at the back, not at any of the stats or any of the scouting reports, but just the old rookie cards. I thought it was pretty fascinating to see the cards organized in that fashion. Now, the Topps Stadium Club set is also pretty unique in that it was a smaller set. That was definitely going against the grain in 1991. We mentioned the 900 card score set. Also, Donruss and Fleer had some pretty big sets, up around the 800 card mark of that year. Well, Topps Stadium Club was a 600 card set, and it only came in two series, so you didn't have to kill yourself trying to track these things down. You did have to pay a little more per pack or a little more per box, but again, getting the sharp photography, getting the great breakdown of a player's career on the back, getting the look at the rookie cards on the back, and of course, having a somewhat limited availability. These were printed in a slightly smaller print run than the base set was in 1991. There was some added value to these cards in a time when baseball cards were just coming out of the yin-yang. Now, while Upper Deck revolutionized the business quite a bit, Topps Stadium Club took it a bit farther. Not only did you have the tamper-proof packaging with the cellophane wax packs, if you will, but you also had this very heavy UV coating on the cards, which was supposed to keep them not only from fading, but getting any kind of other standard damage to them. Now, it was a bitch to get them autographed. I'll tell you that. You know, the player, I actually saw players do this. They would have to sit there with their thumb and like rub out a little part of the card so that they could get their Sharpie marker on there and sign it. But the UV coating was supposed to eliminate fading, eliminate other stains and printing press errors that you could see in some other sets. So that was good then. But much like the Upper Deck foil is peeling off 25 years later, well, the Stadium Club cards, the UV coating was so thick, if you left them in a box long enough, they basically stuck together. So there is a warning out there. If you're looking to build this set here and you've got a stack of cards that you want to go looking through, you may have to literally peel them off each other. Now, it's not like the peeling of gum off of an 81 Donruss card, which of course would destroy the card. But because of this with the UV coating, you have to very gently peel them apart. And there could be, you know, some bowing, there can be some layering as you're trying to pull these cards apart here. So that's the downside of what was at the time a very smart innovation. Now, as I mentioned in 89 Upper Deck, and I've mentioned a few times since, when Upper Deck came out and they put out this premium, quote unquote, standard card set, it raised the bar for everybody, and it took a few years for the rest of the industry to get there. Everybody would get there by 1992. In 1991, you still had these one-off efforts. First of all, Leaf was a set that went out there and was premium. You had the Leaf Studio set. You had the Fleer Ultra set, which wasn't as good, but you know they tried it. And then, of course, you have Top Stadium Club here, which not only, I think, hit that bar, but raised it even more. As I mentioned, especially with photography, Upper Deck had to drop the borders in 1993 to match up with Top Stadium Club. So, you know, as I mentioned, Upper Deck raises the bar. They're the Cadillac of the industry. And then if you use the old General Motors lineup of, all right, here's Cadillac, you know, that was the highest one, and then followed by Buick, and then followed by Pontiac, and then followed by Chevrolet, and, you know, GMC, you know, there was a car for each price level. There was a car for each budget out there. If you were a lower middle class employee, you were not buying a Cadillac. You had to be rich to buy a Cadillac. And likewise, if you were rich, you weren't just going to go puttering around town in a Chevrolet. That was the common man's car. Well, when Upper Deck came around in 89, if you had the extra money, you went out and you bought that. And then you abandoned cards like Bowman and Topps and Donruss because, you know, well, those are for kids. I've got a card set that's for me. Well, with Upper Deck raising that bar, and then with a great effort from cards like Stadium Club, everybody suddenly became Cadillac. And while that was good for the industry, now all of a sudden we have more cards that are looking to have UV coating and tamper-proof packaging and special inserts and, you know, high-quality photography and limited edition insert sets and yada, yada, yada. Well, that took out the common man, which, of course, in the baseball card hobby is, you know, the 12-year-old kid, you know, the kids that, you know, this was a great introduction not only into collecting something, but also, again, pre-internet days, getting into baseball, learning about your favorite players, learning about, you know, your favorite teams, you know, what their uniforms look like, what their stadiums look like, what their logos look like. That's how you learn. So as other card companies started catching up to Upper Deck and Leaf and Stadium Club, then the average little kid who used to buy a pack for 50 cents but now has to buy one for $3 and get less cards in there, you know, that really undercut the foundation of the hobby for many years. And that foundation getting cut out, I think it took about 15 to 20 years to really reestablish that. And what's established it is not the card itself, because you still have these high quality, great photography, UV coated, you know, tamper proof packaging, special inserts. They still make it, but it's really, it's people like me and you who have young kids who kind of bring them into the industry. That's what's kind of saving the youth in this industry now. I guarantee you, finding somebody between the age of 10 and 25 who collects or collected baseball cards, very few and far between. An entire generation was wiped out because everybody tried to be the Cadillac. And that was definitely the case in 1992. As you'll see when we go through these old sets, Fleer caught up. They tried to be a Cadillac. Donruss caught up. They tried to be a Cadillac. Score caught up. They were more of a Buick. They weren't quite a Cadillac. Upper Deck again had to, all right, they were already a Cadillac. Well, they had to add the gold trimmed wheels because you had Stadium Club cruising around here. And sets like, remember this one, we'll talk about it in 1992, Triple Play. That was a Donruss set that was geared towards kids. It failed miserably because everybody was going after the Cadillacs and nobody wanted the AMC Gremlin. So, you know, Stadium Club now, it looks great. It feels great. Doesn't really smell great. I never liked the smell of the UV coating compared to the toxic in a good way smell of wax, bubblegum, and cardboard. But Stadium Club was a great addition to the hobby. Like I said, it's still one of my favorite sets, certainly from 91 and the early 90s. There's some value to the cards. It still lives on to this day. But that was another shoe to drop after Upper Deck. And then, like I said, you had companies like Leaf and, you know, Fleer with their Ultra set trying to catch up. Well, once Stadium Club came, boom. That was the big burst that, well, hey, if Topps can make this, then we can make it. And we're not going to make a separate set for it, even though Fleer had Ultra and, the Leaf Company, which also made Donruss cards, you know, they had their Leaf brand going out. But then they just said, you know what? We have to make our base set like Stadium Club or like Upper Deck. That was how they survived. And by surviving in the short term, it really undercut the hobby in the long term. Not only that next round of kids, that next generation of children who were born in the late 80s and early 90s and raised in the 90s and early 2000s, not only were they lost, but unfortunately a lot of cards from those years are still just flooding the market here. Now again, let's take a look at our random pull, which is Roberto Alomar. And this is one of my favorite players from my Blue Jay fandom days because this guy, we got to see the evolution of a Hall of Fame player, even though he wasn't originally drafted by the Blue Jays. Coming over from San Diego, he was a guy that, you know, at first a lot of people were going, wait, who is this guy? You know, you knew he was a top prospect from San Diego, but to give up longtime Blue Jay Tony Fernandez, and of course Fred McGriff getting traded for Joe Carter, we knew then it was a win-win trade for both sides, but there were still some unknowns about Alomar because he was young, and when your career was starting in San Diego in the late 80s, you were pretty much off the radar. Well, that would certainly change not that much longer after the trade happened in December of 1990. He would arrive in Toronto in time for the 1991 season, and this guy was just on a tear. Of course, Roberto was the brother of Sandy Alomar Jr., who was a longtime catcher, mostly with the Cleveland Indians, but also both Sandy Jr. and Roberto were the son of Sandy Sr., who was a professional baseball player throughout much of the 1970s, also the 60s as well, had a pretty serviceable career. Of course, Roberto really setting the pace. And I remember even back in 1990, 91, if you ask most baseball fans, okay, which of the Alomars is going to be a Hall of Fame player? I think most people said Sandy Jr. because defensively, this guy was a wizard behind the plate for the Indians. He had a cannon of an arm. I mean, he could throw out anybody trying to steal second base. And of course, he was part of that young nucleus of Cleveland Indians talent that was going to eventually start turning things around and winning things in Cleveland. Well, Roberto comes along, and not only does he shore up the middle of the field for the Blue Jays, but this is a guy wherever he went, for the most part, throughout his career. He won 12-time All-Star. He was a two-time World Series champion with the Jays in 92 and 93. Also, the ALCS MVP in 92 against the juggernaut Oakland Athletics. 10 times he won the Gold Glove Award at second base. And he was also a four-time Silver Slugger. And he is the only Toronto Blue Jay to not only be inducted in the Hall of Fame as a member of the Toronto Blue Jays, but also the only Blue Jay to have his number retired, the number 12, no longer worn. Now, I still argue Dave Steeb's 37 should be up there, but that's for another time. But Alomar's career is well known. You know, he made his major league debut in 1988 with the Padres, was then moved in that deal to Toronto, and that's where he really became a star. In 1995, he was a free agent, picked up by the Baltimore Orioles, and again, the Orioles won with Alomar in the lineup. But of course, some controversy, very well known. In 1996, it was at the end of the season, Alomar gets into an argument with John Hirschbeck over balls and strikes. Well, Alomar just loses it and spits in Hirschbeck's face. So Hirschbeck, of course, throws him out of the game. And then, you know, the umpires union is upset over what's going on. And the Orioles are trying desperately not to have this guy out of the lineup because he was such a key contributor to the Orioles' success at the time. Well, Alomar decides to turn this unfortunate event into a first-class douchebag event where, you know, when people are saying, well, why did you spit on him? He says that, you know, Hirschbeck, you know, said something racial to Alomar. And, well, Hirschbeck's got a bad, you know, attitude anyways because, you know, his son died and he's got another kid that's going to be dying soon. And the kids were affected by ALD, which is, for lack of a better term, kind of a childhood ALS almost, where as the disease progresses, it's a neurological disease, as the disease progresses, basically the kids become incapacitated, and it's a genetic disease. It's not something that can strike out of nowhere like an ALS or an MS can. So, you know, you're already turning this really, really bad thing into something a million times worse by saying, well, he called me a name and he's just upset because his kids are dead from this disease he has no control over. Oh, well, that's pretty nice. And Hirschbeck, of course, hears about this after the game and damn near kills Alomar. He's basically on a manhunt trying to track down Alomar and just rip him to shreds. So somebody fortunately was able to step in between them and prevent that from happening. Now, Alomar was suspended for the first five regular season games in 1997. There was this dark cloud hanging over him for the 1996 playoff run, which the Orioles were involved with. And eventually, publicly, they kissed and made up. In fact, that following season, you know, they made a goodwill gesture. And when Alomar retired, he basically, you know, regretted getting involved in that, but also said, you know, that was so long ago, I've really moved on from it. And that was that. Now, after his time in Baltimore, which again was brief, but for the most part, pretty successful, Alomar would move on to the Cleveland Indians, signing as a free agent in 1998. The Indians had some good years in 99 and 2000, but after the 2001 season, management decides to blow up the whole thing. So he gets traded in a big deal to the New York Mets. Well, what do you know? The Mets had a pretty decent run of success there. Of course, not as good as 2000 with the World Series run, which ended at the hand of the Yankees. But he was there in 2002 for half of the 2003 season before the Mets dish him away to the White Sox. So he only plays a few months with the White Sox in 2003, signs as a free agent with Arizona in 2004, traded by Arizona back to the White Sox in 2004, finishes up his time in Chicago, the second stint, that is, after that season. And then I fondly remember in the spring training of 2005, he was wearing a Tampa Bay Devil Rays jersey. General manager Chuck Lamar, in his infinite wisdom to not bring up anybody with any talent to the major league team by then, he was really hoping that Alomar could eke out one more year at second base, basically hold down the fort while the youngsters were getting better in the minor leagues. No, that didn't happen. Alomar, in the middle of spring training, claimed, oh, my back is killing me and, you know, my eyesight's not as good, so I'm going to retire. And that left the Rays in a lurch because they didn't really have anybody else at second base. I think they eventually had, like, Terry Shumpert playing second base for them for much of the year there. So it wasn't quite exactly the way that the Rays planned it out. And that was the end of the Hall of Fame career there. 17 years in the big leagues, 2,379 games. Roberto Alomar, 210 home runs, career batting average of .300. He was the number three hitter in the American League in 1993. And he only hit .326. He was behind John Olerud and Paul Molitor. Oh, by the way, that was only the 2, 3, and 4 spots in the Blue Jays order that year. And also, he had 2,724 base hits. Now, he didn't have 400 home runs. He didn't have 3,000 hits, but he did have all of those gold gloves. His career fielding percentage, which again was spent mostly at second base. There were a handful of games where he was a shortstop, but his career fielding percentage, .984. That's in 2,320 games at second base. That's pretty darn good. And especially considering where some of those games were played. You had the AstroTurf days of the Sky Dome in Toronto. You had the always shoddy infield at Shea Stadium. And you also had quite a bit of cold outdoor performances in Cleveland, Chicago, and even Baltimore for, you know, April and September, October. So here was a guy who wasn't exactly always in the best position to succeed in his position, be it turf, be it field conditions, be it weather conditions, but he managed to find a way to perform extremely well. He had tremendous range. He had a pretty good arm, too. This goes back to the Pat Gillick days of building the old-fashioned baseball club, and that was power on the corners, defense up the middle. And with Roberto Alomar, it didn't matter who you had at shortstop. And the Jays had a rotation of players at shortstop. You had Manny Lee. You had Eddie Zosky. You had Rance Mullinix. I mean, you had all sorts of guys at shortstop. Roberto Alomar cleaned up a lot of that mess. And I remember when he was with Baltimore, I mean, he was paired up with Cal Ripken Jr. And Ripken was still in his prime, even in his final 3-4 years of his playing career. Robbie Alomar, I mean, I saw it from my own eyes. You know, if you were able to see it, dial up some of Robbie Alomar's Gold Glove winning performances on the field throughout those 17 years, and you will see why. He was just absolutely phenomenal. So a phenomenal pick here, pulling Roberto Alomar out of Top Stadium Club, a phenomenal set, a set that you could still buy relatively on the cheap. You can get boxes for, I've seen them listed around $20 a piece, again, not including shipping. Sets, you know, I don't think I looked at a set. I think it's valued at around $35 or $40. I may be off a couple bucks there. But compared to other sets from 1991, you know, Stadium Club common cards are valued anywhere between 50 and 75 cents. Most other sets from that year, common cards are 3 cents. So there's even value to the common card. So you can get the complete set at a decent price. You can pick up some wax boxes at a decent price. And this is one of those sets, much like 86 Donruss, much like 87 Fleer. I think they're undervalued a little bit. I think they're great sets. You can get boxes at a really good price these days. I'm not going to promise that the value of the set will go up or any of the cards will go up. In fact, it'll probably take another 25 years for them to go up $10 for the entire set. But I would think that this is one of those sets that would not depreciate in value, at least that much. So if you got a few bucks, you got a little time, buy a couple of boxes. See what you get. I think you'll find yourself putting together a pretty nice set of cards. I actually did that when I was a kid with Stadium Club Hockey, 91-92 Top Stadium Club Hockey. I still have the set. It's a beautiful set. I think you could do the same thing with baseball, too. Put it together, see what you get. You're probably not going to spend more than 40 or 50 bucks doing it. And I think you'll have a really classy set that you can show off for many years. And, you know, like I said, you can thumb through and look at all the great pictures on the front or all the old rookie cards on the back. And I don't think you'll be disappointed with it. So definitely give 91 Stadium Club a second look, because it really did continue raising the bar. Granted, everybody was trying to be the Cadillac that Upper Deck became in 1989. But the 91 Stadium Club set, like I said, if you have a few bucks, get some boxes. They're out there. They're pretty cheap. And you'd be amazed at what you put together in a pretty good set, I do say myself. All right, that's it for Top Stadium Club and Roberto Alomar. If you have anything you want to say about our random poll about the set or anything about the hobby, join in the conversation at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Again, send us, in your opinion, your 10 worst baseball card sets, not necessarily ones that you own, just in your opinion, the 10 worst. Try to put them in order 1 through 10, and we will go through those this upcoming Friday for our next podcast, which will be about the final set from 1991, one of my favorites, and the last of the true classic baseball card, 91 Tops. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining us and for putting up with my nasally nose, as we'll be back on Friday with another edition of the Wax Ecstatic Podcast.